I am these days chaplain at University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario, Canada, and Wilfrid Laurier University, which used to be Waterloo Lutheran University. Little Lutheran Seminary there, one of two in Canada, the other being in Saskatchewan. Anyhow, I'm chaplain at both of those campuses. I've spent most of my life in campus ministry. And the title of this session is going to be Spirituality for Today. And there's a kind of subtitle, too, which I'm calling Tuning the Human Instrument. I'd like to think of this as part of our responsibility to keep our human instrument in top shape. And that would be physically and spiritually and intellectually and emotionally and all those things. Some of you have met my wife already. Her name is Kathy, and she teaches family and life, family and child, family, couple communication, that kind of stuff, including this week here at Holden. And she came back from a conference a couple of years ago with an interesting set of statistics. There was a study made that was reported on at this conference. And the study had to do with couples who greeted each other or did not greet each other at the beginning of the day and the end of the day. In other words, when the father or the husband or the wife went off to work in the morning, did they or did they not embrace and kiss? And when the husband or wife came back from work at the end of the day, did they or did they not embrace and kiss? That was the only variable that was under study. Somebody's watch? What's that strange noise? Is it somebody's watch? It's a beeper. Oh, I wish I had a clock. It's not a wristwatch that goes that loud, is it? Isn't that wonderful? I'm slightly deaf. I'm slightly deaf, and I have a wristwatch that's supposed to be an alarm, but I can never hear it. We will all pause a minute until we get the best of our technology. That's quite all right. Crazy. Isn't that funny? Maybe it'll wear out, huh? Maybe the battery will run down. Too many pockets in these new bags. Is a bedside alarm? It's a beeper. I mean, it's an alarm.
It's a travel alarm.
A travel alarm, wonderful. I wish I had the ears. As I say, I bought this thing especially because it had an alarm, and I thought, gee, it can wake me up when I'm away at conferences, but I can't hear it at all. Anyhow, this study that my wife reported on, I mean, she reported on the report of it, only studied this. Did these couples at the beginning of the day embrace and kiss when they parted for work? And when they reunited again at the end of the day, after work was over, did they or did they not embrace and kiss? And the study proved very conclusively that the couples that did embrace and kiss at the beginning of the day and at the end of the day had happier marriages, longer-lasting marriages, more fulfilling marriages than those couples that did not embrace and kiss at the beginning and at the end of the day. Apparently, the embrace and the kiss made all the difference. And the very interesting part of the statistic was this: it didn't make any difference whether or not they meant it. There are days like that, right? It didn't make any difference whether or not they were sincere. You know, there are days when you get up out of bed or there's something that troubles you or bothers you and you give her a peck on the cheek or whatever. But that's all that's needed. Sometimes. Now, I would be the last to say that that's all that's needed. But it does show how we become what we do and how what we do affects us and molds us and shapes us. Walter Huffman, some of you may know, teaches at Columbus, Ohio Seminary there. He reports having read about an interviewer who spoke to Bob Hope, the comedian. I wouldn't normally be quoting much of Bob Hope, but he was very insightful. The interviewer asked him, "Are you the same kind of fellow off stage that you appear to be when you're on stage?" And Hope's answer was this: "I did not used to be, but now I am." Isn't that interesting? In other words, what we do shapes us. It has the power to shape us. That's one reason for worship every week. It's one reason for prayers, one reason for a whole catalog of spiritual disciplines. I will now erase the foot from the board because I want to write other things. This was from the last session. Anyhow, spirituality would have been something that 10 years ago I wouldn't have thought of touching. I mean, it was just bizarre to me. Spirituality? I was even suspicious of it, as a matter of fact. And I think a lot of Lutherans are suspicious of it for two reasons. One, because I used to think spiritual, does that mean not physical or anti-physical or anti-material? And to talk about someone's spirituality seemed to me to be kind of ghostly and unincarnated. You know the word incarnation? It means in the flesh. And we talk about God the Lord coming in the flesh in Jesus. Incarnated or incarnation. Carne, you know, chili con carne, it means flesh or meat. In the meat of human life. Jesus came in the flesh of human life. And that has always been very precious to me, and I think it's precious to Lutherans generally, but precious to the whole Christian tradition. And that incarnation means you take that flesh and that meat very seriously, that stuff of creation. And I thought when people started to talk about spirituality that they were inviting me to abandon that commitment that I saw that God had for the physical and the material. And I thought that was a mistake. But I learned that doesn't have to be. And as a matter of fact, the finest and truest spirituality is an incarnated spirituality. A spirituality that's right into the meat and the flesh and the stuff of life. So that was my one misgiving, that spirituality seemed to be anti-incarnational or anti or against the body. Or the material, or the stuff of the creation. And I saw God in Jesus, particularly in the incarnation, in the birth of Jesus, and in the crucifixion and death and resurrection of Jesus, that God was endorsing the physical. Anyhow, I see that there is that it's possible to have a spirituality that is incarnated, that is in the flesh, in the stuff of creation. So that was my first misgiving. My second misgiving was works righteousness. You've heard about that, I'm sure, from Lutheran pulpits and Lutheran teaching. Lutherans like to say that they are saved, and everybody is saved by grace, by God's grace. And there's nothing you have to do to earn heaven. And I think that's true. And so I was suspicious when people talked about spirituality and talked about praying and going on retreats and fasting and saying prayers of one kind or another at different times during the day and so on. I thought, golly, are these people now assuming that because they do that, God loves them? You see what I thought? It could be like earning your way into heaven. Could be like work. What that's called works righteousness. And I didn't want any part of that. I mean, I thought, boy, that's bad news. The good news is that God loves you and accepts you and takes you as a child, quite apart from what you do or how you act or how many prayers you say. And I thought that when you talked about spirituality in terms of the discipline of living a spiritual life, that that was going to tempt people into thinking that they were going to earn their way into heaven. Well, I was wrong in thinking that too. And I see now that spirituality can be a response. In fact, I would say it represents any response, anything that Christian people do, Christian community does, as a response to God's grace. Almost anything the Christian community does and Christian people in that community do in response to the grace of God. But it's always response. God loves you first. You do not have to earn it. You do not have to work your way into heaven. That's the good news. But having accepted the good news, you want to put it to work in your life, and that means a spirituality, and let us hope a spirituality for today. And I'm calling this in the kind of subtitle, Tuning the Human Instrument. Because I think what is required of us, particularly us in this generation, is a human instrument, by which I mean me and my person and all that I am, my body, my soul, my emotions, my intellect, the right brain, the left brain, everything about me, talents, abilities, inheritances, all of that, as an advertisement for the gospel. I want to be a good advertisement for the gospel. And my prayer for you is that you be a good advertisement for the gospel. When people look at you, they ought to be able to say, that person is something like God. Martin Luther, you know, says, we are Christs to one another. You sometimes hear that, we are little Christs, but I heard a Luther scholar say, no, there's no diminutive in Luther. It's Christ. You are to be a Christ to your neighbor. I am to be a Christ to you. You are to be a Christ to me. And the question then that spirituality raises, how can I do that better and more effectively? So, that's what we're talking about in these sessions, and that's what I'd like to focus with you for the next few minutes. Urban Holmes, U-R-B-A-N is his first name, H-O-L-M-E-S, like Sherlock Holmes. That's his second name, his last name. He has a neat diagram in a book that he writes. I think the title of the book is Patterns of Western Spirituality. Or maybe it's Patterns of Christian Spirituality. I think that may be it. Anyhow, he draws a kind of a chart that looks like this. The four compass points. And up here in the north, you might say, he says this is what patterns of spirituality look like. And I think that might be useful to spend a minute and take a look at it. He says, up here is the kind of spirituality that wants to enlighten the mind. It's a head thing. You want a rational explanation for things. You want a faith that makes sense to your reason. Nothing wrong with that, it's great. But that's one end of a continuum, you might say. And the other end of the continuum is, as you might guess it, heart. There's another kind of spirituality, quite different, that wants to enlighten the heart and the emotions and the feelings and bring that into tune with the Lord's will. This wants to bring the mind and the rationality and the intellect into tune with God's will. This wants to bring the heart, the emotions, the feelings into tune with God's will. Both are equally valid, but they're, in a sense, at different ends of the continuum. Now, here's another continuum from east to west. Over here in the east, here's an incredible word for you. You can go home from Holden Village and say, I learned a new word. In fact, you're going to learn two new words today. He calls that cataphatic. Isn't that a marvelous word? Cataphatic people are people who are committed to and interested in and get a lot out of forms, such as hymn books, doctrines, church architecture, liturgies, vestments, ceremonies and rituals. All that kind of stuff is what Urban Holmes calls cataphatic. And we have a Bible, and we have a hymn book, and we have church buildings, and we have liturgies and so on, and we have hymns. All of that is cataphatic stuff, and it's great. I love it, for one. I'm very, very cataphatic. But there's another end of the continuum, too. And this is more foreign to me, but I must say it's beginning to speak to me and beginning to make more and more sense. And this is, as you might guess if you know Greek, apophatic. And the apophatic personality is the kind of personality that's suspicious of forms, is worried that all these rituals and words and hymns and liturgies and church architecture and doctrines even, and even the Bible, can get in the way of you and God. So the apophatic end of the spectrum, or end of the continuum, is the kind of person who is a little uneasy or a little suspicious of those forms, any kind of form, and wants to come to God, so to speak, with empty hands. It's an empty. That side is full. This side is empty. Okay, let's take a look at what these quadrants might represent. Up here in the northeast, with a kind of spirituality that enlightens the mind and is also cataphatic, that is, it's interested in forms like words and symbols and rituals and doctors and so on, you would have rationalism. The founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, those kind of guys were, you know, they were godly people, and they were relatively rational. They had high respect for the intellect, and they had high respect for words, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution of the United States, etc. But there's a great tradition within the church, too, the more traditional church, including Lutheran, that's very rational. You may have heard of the 17th century Lutheran rationalists. Okay, how about the southeast? Still cataphatic, that is, still interested in forms like words and liturgies and architecture and vestments and ceremonies and so on, but more interested in enlightening the heart, the feelings, the emotions, would be, have you guessed it? Pietism. I was raised as a German pietist. My dad was a pastor. My goodness, all that applause. I'm going to feel jealous. My dad was a Lutheran pastor, third generation in this country, but he was German background, and he came out of a tradition of German pietism. And he loved hymns, and he taught us how to sing hymns, and we read the Bible around the table, and he wanted to have children, and he wanted to influence his family and his congregation in the ways of enlightening the heart, that our motives and our feelings and our emotions were pure. And I thank him for that. He was also a scholar, my father, and so he was up in here somewhere a lot of days. but for the most part, he was kind of a German pietist. Okay, down in this end of things, it's a little more unfamiliar to us, but I think we'd have to call the Quakers and the Mennonites, those kind of people, down in this, Mennonites. I live in a part of Canada, incidentally, it's full of Mennonites, Pennsylvania Dutch, came up from Pennsylvania 150 years ago in covered wagons, and almost every day by my house trots a horse and buggy with the people, with the plain clothes, you know, black button hooks and so on, beards on the men, straw hats, veils on the women. Those are the Mennonites, and the Quakers too, you see, they're a little suspicious of liturgies. Anyone been to a Quaker service? You know what they're like? Have you heard about them, maybe? Quaker service on Sunday morning, everybody sits in silence. No hymns, for the most part. I mean, there are different kinds of Quakers. There are different kinds of Mennonites, too. But the Quakers are very austere. When you feel moved by the Spirit of God, then you stand up and speak and make a witness or a testimony. But there's no written prayers. There's no liturgy, so to speak. The architecture of the building is very severe, very austere, just a big room with benches. And the service is very unadorned. So the Quakers and the Mennonites, those kind of people, would be down here. And up here, the most exotic of all, in my experience anyhow, are the so-called Desert Fathers. Have you ever heard of the Desert Fathers? There were also Desert Mothers, incidentally. But the Desert Fathers were the guys who went away in caves, you know, and lived like a guru, and people sought them out for their advice and their spirituality. Christians. Desert Fathers are going to put mothers, too. Because they were both male and female, and they lived a very solitary, very austere, monkish life, like a hermit almost, and they were very much interested in the mind and also kind of suspicious of all the forms that human beings have developed. We were in Israel November, December of last year, and we drove down one of these canyons in the bus. Oh, my Lord, you never saw such landscape. I mean, the Grand Canyon is like a garden compared to some of Israel. Not a bush, not a tree, not a blade of grass, nothing but sky and rock and canyon. And on the side of a canyon, way across the way from us, was a little monastery in a cave The cave is where Elijah was fed by the ravens, according to tradition. And this was an Orthodox, Russian Orthodox monastery where the priests lived very austere and very secluded lives. And there was even a hermitage there across a little ravine, across a little gully, where a hermit lived. And they passed, there was a you could see a pulley and a cable. And they would feed him his food on a basket with the pulley and the cable. And that hermit lived in that cave. He's one of these guys. Well, that is what the totality of Christian spirituality might look like. And I want to ask, play a little game with you now, if you would be willing. Take a look at that chart. And by the time I count three, determine where you are now in your life, in your journey. Are you somewhere over here? Are you somewhere over here, here, here? Let's even ask for four volunteers. Who's willing to help? Can I have four volunteers? Don't be shy. Would you be willing? Come here, stand up. Let me have you stand. Let me have you stand here at this end of the room and point to your head. You'll be the mind man. Okay. Another volunteer? Don't be shy. Very good. Stand at that end of the room and hold your hand over your heart.
Where here?
Yeah, you're way over here by this pillow. You see what I'm doing? I'm putting on the floor of this room this chart. This is mind up here. This is heart over there. Okay, now here we got cataphatic. That means forms, books, Bibles, doctrines, liturgies, hymns. Who wants to be that over here? Would you stand over there with those books? Who wants to be the apophatic end of the pole? You can be it. Just stand there or sit there with your hands like this. And these are the people who just want to think of you and God all alone. Okay, by the time I count three, make your choice. Then stand up and mill around here and stand in the quadrant where you think you'd be most comfortable. You get what I'm saying? Okay, go ahead, move around. This is mind. This is form.
Can they go?
We're all typically Lutheran. Most happy, in other words, with liturgies and architecture and vestments and a certain amount of ceremony, that kind of thing, right? And you're maybe a little suspicious of the mind, you like the heart a little better, right? Now, some of you are over here on this side of the line. You're way over here, eh? Really? You're suspicious. You're suspicious of forms. Is that what I'm hearing? Don't like them. Yeah, okay. Now let's change the exercise. Let's ask if in recent years or days you've thought, gee, there's maybe something in another quadrant that is appealing to me, that could maybe have something to tell me. Would you be willing to shift your position when I count three and move in the direction of a quadrant that seems to be kind of calling you? Do any of you people feel yourself moving this way, or do any of you people feel yourself moving this way? Some of you do, sure. Nobody's going to grade you on this. Very interesting. I find myself drawn over this way more today, although I'm still pretty much on this side of the dividing line, I think. But I feel myself drawn over here. Okay, sit down. That's just a little experiment. Thank you for your help. We're grateful. Okay, for you people who are suspicious uncomfortable with ritual, let me make a definition for you. My definition would be that people need ritual, and people are ritual inventors. And if we don't have ritual, our lives are somehow impoverished because of it, because of not having it, that is. Now, once you have it, then you can withdraw from it for a little bit or for a period. But ritual, there's a difference between ritual and routine. Ritual is something that you do repeatedly that you would miss if you did not do it. My goodness. Like brushing your teeth in a certain way, you know, that's a kind of a ritual after some years. You get used to doing it a certain way and you'd be uncomfortable doing it another way. Or arranging your workspace on Monday morning or whenever, you know, you want to arrange it just so to fit you. Those are rituals. Cuddling with your spouse in bed in a certain way. My wife and I go through a little dance there in bed, and we roll on the right side and the left side, and before we go to sleep, you know, there's the alpha position and there's the beta position. Do you know any of that kind of stuff? It's kind of interesting. Anyhow, most people have little rituals like that that enrich their lives. So there's nothing wrong with that. Ritual is something you do repeatedly that you would miss if you did not do it. Routine is something you do repeatedly which you would not miss if you did not do it. Like taking out the garbage every Saturday. That's routine. And nobody wants ritual to become routine. Ritual can become routine. But it shouldn't, and it doesn't have to. Okay, let us take a look then at tuning the human instrument now here from a more practical and more specific point of view. Again, we're not trying to take you away from the human or from the physical or from the material or from the incarnational aspect of things. And of all things, we are not trying to say this is the way you earn God's love. This is a response, right? It's not the way to earn God's love. It's a response to God's love. Let me list for you 20 different, what I'm calling spiritual skills that ought to enrich your life if you're serious about tuning the human instrument. Holy Communion, regular participation and reception in Holy Communion. I think that ought to be somewhere near the top of the list. When we get down to the bottom of the list, we'll see you can kind of flip the list because they're both ends are very important. Well, even the middle is important. You're aware, I'm sure, that the ecumenical movement, that is the movement of unity between all the churches, has pointed out the centrality of the Holy Communion among all the denominations. And Martin Luther just assumed that the Holy Communion would be there every Sunday. John Calvin assumed that the Holy Communion would be there every Sunday. John Wesley, the founder of Methodism, assumed the Holy Communion every Sunday. So that's good to remember, and it's good also to recall that it's only in the last 200 years that we've fallen away from that and have it, what, four times a year when I was a kid? Once a month now in most of your churches? Once a month? Twice a month, okay. Well, I hope the day comes when it'll be every week in all our churches, because that'll be the Catholic way. I mean, Catholic small c, not big C, not Roman Catholic. Roman Catholics are judged by this too. But Catholic, that is ecumenical, universal. Okay, Holy Communion. The next term I'm going to use may not be familiar to you. I'm going to call it the daily office. That's a technical term, but it means things like matins and vespers and prayers at home around the mealtime, or prayers at home in the morning, or prayers at home at night. As you may or may not know, the monks in their monasteries established a program of prayers 7 times a day. Matins, if I'm not mistaken, was at midnight. 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 hours later, they got up again and they had lauds. 9 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, they got up again and had, what would it be, prime. 9 o'clock in the morning, terse. Still, all of them very similar, little prayer offices with psalms and readings and prayers. Noontime, noontime would be sext. Nones would be the ninth hour, which is 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Vespers would be 6 p.m. in the evening. And then compline, any of you here for compline last night in this room? That at 9 p.m., the bedtime prayer of the church. And then the whole cycle begins again at midnight. So you had 7 or 8 times during the day, every 3 hours, prayers, scripture readings, psalms, hymns. Now, in our green book, we have only 3 of those. We have morning prayer, matins, evening prayer, vespers, and compline, the bedtime prayer of the church. And they're neat, and we should get to know them. And I would say every family and every household and every single ought to have some kind of routine whereby they pray and read the Bible every day. Maybe not 7 or 8 times during the day. I mean, that may be a little much. Maybe only a monk can do that. But we ought to have some kind of discipline in our lives that allows the whole calendar and the whole rhythm of the day and the rhythm of the week and the rhythm of the year to affect us. Okay, the third thing I'm going to write down is the psalm book. And by psalms, I'm also going to put hymns. my Lord, what are they doing out there? We really ought to ask the neighbor, shouldn't we, when this is all over? I realized from my dad's training, I mean, the way I was brought up, hymns are just a very important part of my piety and my spirituality. And I find myself walking across the village here singing a hymn to myself. Or singing a pop tune, too, for that matter. But singing is important. And the psalms and the hymns are the hymn book of the church, and we ought to know them. That's three. Four, retreat. Some people would like to find a better word for it than retreat. It should not be retreat. It should be going forward. We're not going back like a retreating army. We're going forward. But in any case, you know what I mean when I use the word. Holden Village is a retreat center. Wouldn't it be great if every Christian had a chance to experience what you're experiencing? Once a year, to have, maybe twice a year, have an opportunity to go away on a retreat for a couple of days or a week to get those batteries recharged. Christians need that. Everybody needs it. Some kind of opportunity for retreat. Okay, active prayer I'm going to put down next. And that's going to be different from contemplative prayer, which I will talk about in a minute. Active prayer is the prayer that most of us are used to. It has four parts to it. Ignatius of Loyola invented a system. 1, lectio, 2, meditatio, 3, oratio, and 4, adoratio. Lectio, that's first, that means reading. But it means not just reading the Bible, although you might want to read the Bible, but it means also reading the evidence around you, including the evidence of nature and the daily headlines, looking and gathering in to yourself all the stuff that's out there, including, of course, the Bible. That's lectio, the first step. Then second, meditatio, meditation, thinking about it. It's left brain. I mean, it's up here at the top of the chart. And it's thinking and putting your mind to it. What is the meaning of this for me today? What I've read out of the Bible, or what I see in the headlines, or what I observe in nature, or what I remember from conversation with a friend. You're meditating. You're thinking about that. Then the third step, oratio, that's pray. You offer this up to God. You may not understand it. You may not come to a conclusion rationally, but nevertheless, you offer this up to God. You say, God, make something out of this. Help me to make something out of it. That's praying. And you might also want to pray for others and for the world and for your family and for, there's all kinds of intercessions and prayers that we can make. You're aware, are you, that in the beginning of the book, in the front pages of the book here, there are some wonderful prayers. Wonderful list of prayers here that help you to learn how to pray. Nothing wrong with taking somebody else's words and using them. That can be equally sincere as making up your own words. That's the third step. Then the fourth step, adoratio, that's adoration. Just adoring God, remaining in the presence of God all day. That's the four-step active prayer. Contemplative prayer is a little more exotic to me, but again, more and more important and more useful. This is more Eastern and more like the Orthodox tradition, maybe even more like Buddhism and Hinduism for that matter. But it's the kind of prayer where you seek a place apart, you seek a private space. One of the saints used to climb up a tree. You may go off in a cave, you may just go to your room, or you may, walk around here somewhere. Anyhow, find a space apart, and then take to yourself a little phrase or even just a single word out of scripture or out of your tradition or out of your memory that seems to sum up your mood for the day or for the moment. It may be alleluia, which means praise to the Lord. That's a Hebrew word that means praise to the Lord. It may be Lord, have mercy. It may be the Jesus prayer. Jesus, Lamb of God, have mercy on me. It may be a phrase, blessed are the merciful. It could be almost anything, but you concentrate on this and you repeat it to yourself over and over and over and over again. It sounds kind of mindless. And in a sense it is. It's not up here anymore, it's down here. And it's over to this end of the scale a little more apophatic. Because what you're trying to do is get into the presence of God and kind of down into the depths, so to speak. So much of our thoughts, you see, are up here at the surface of this river that's moving along, your river of consciousness, and there's a lot of flotsam and jetsam and garbage that's floating along on the surface. And the point of this kind of prayer is to get into the depths. And you're repeating that prayer over and over to yourself and reminding yourself of God's goodness. And if every now and then your attention should wander and you should get up in the surface where all the garbage is, just go back down again. I mean, that happens even to the saints. But you just go back down again and repeat these words over and over to yourself again. There's some who are so practiced at this, they can go all through the day, sewing or cleaning or working at a lathe in a machine shop, and they're still praying. That's quite foreign to me, but it works. You have Roman Catholic friends who use the rosary? Something like that. You know, they go with the beads, and they repeat the Our Father, and they repeat the Hail Mary, and so on. It sounds to us like vain repetition. But believe me, there's something to it, and they get something out of it. And maybe we should learn something about it. The Jews, for that matter, have what is called a talus, or a prayer shawl, which they wear, some very beautiful kind of garment. It's like a big... shawl, and it has a special fringe on it that's knotted, a kind of ritual macrame. And the knots are related to numerology. You have a knot and 7 wrappings, and a knot and 8 wrappings, and another knot and 11 wrappings, and another knot and 13 wrappings, and another knot. Anyhow, all those knots have numbers associated with them, and the wrappings and so on, and what it, have letters associated with it, and what it spells out is God is one. And you will see the Jews, as we did, at the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, praying, and they may be fingering the knots in their talus. Something like that. Awareness prayer, that's number 7. Awareness prayer is something we can do right now. We can do any of these right now. But let me have you close your eyes for a minute, sit there in the chair. Let me have you offer a brief prayer of praise to God, just praise, in your own words, silently to yourself. Now let me have you review the day. What happened the last 24 hours? Good and bad alike, everything that happened to you. As you review the day now, select one positive experience. Something that gave you pleasure or joy. And meditate on that. Think about it. Contemplate it. Now give thanks to God for that experience. And select a negative experience from the past 24 hours. And contemplate that. Think about that for a minute. Something uncomfortable or painful that happened. Just contemplate that experience for a moment. Now give thanks to God even for that experience and perhaps confess your failings in the situation. And conclude again with a brief prayer of praise. Okay, open your eyes now. That's very simple. It can take 15 minutes. It can take a little longer. I kind of rushed you through it. But that kind of exercise done every day at the end of the day is a very helpful thing. You would be a better person in a month if you did that every day from now on for the next 30 days. Okay, that's awareness prayer. 8, journal keeping. Boy, I'm not going to be able to write all these on the board. Journal keeping. I keep a journal. It's not a diary, really. Where did I have it? I have it over here. It's not really a diary. This is my mine is number 13. I've done 13 of these. Commonplace book, number 13. The old preachers had a commonplace book, that's what they called it, where they wrote down commonplaces, little sermon ideas, little thought starters. I've got several pages already here on Dale and on Ed and on all the other fellows who are here and the people who are making presentations. I just write down stuff that appeals to me and go back and read it. Very useful. Dream work, that's the next thing on my list. Number 9, would you believe that you can learn from your own dreams? The presumption in dream work is that God is trying to help you to understand what's eating you these days. And if you dream, you might want to keep a pad and pencil by your bed and write down the dream when you wake up. And if you do that often enough, the dream will begin to interpret itself to you. Here's a little exercise, TTAQ. Dreams. T-T-A-Q. Title, theme, effect, and question. After you write down a dream, the rough outline of it, ask, what title does this dream want to have? What might be a title that I would, if I were to make a movie out of it or a book? That's T. The second T is theme. What theme or themes might this dream have? Is there a theme or a series of themes? Effect, that's A. What effect did the dream have on me as I dreamed it? Was I anxious? Was I frustrated? Was I pleased and happy? Was I sexually aroused? All of that stuff is okay. I mean, dreams, including the sexy ones or the scary ones, nightmares and so on, all of those dreams are in symbolic language. They are metaphors. You shouldn't take the dream literally. But the dream is telling you something symbolically and metaphorically. So you ask, what is the effect, the emotional effect that that dream had on me as I was dreaming it? And then finally, Q, what question does the dream ask of me in my life today? The dream is, chances are, posing some problem for you and trying to help you solve it. And you ask, what is that question that that dream is asking me? That's one way to understand your dreams. I read a book that gave 37 different dream work techniques. Guided meditation with a friend or spiritual director, Dale, if you were here the last couple of days, Dale did a lot of that. Guided meditation, he'd have you sit there, close your eyes, he'd take you through a series of exercises. You need a spiritual director or a friend who knows something about it to help you with that. Sensitive listening skills, that's the next thing on my list, number 11. Have you heard about Maslow and Flanders and Kharkov and Pearls and Ellis and all those people? They have ways that help you to get in touch with other people. You see, now we're moving away from liturgy and ritual, aren't we, and into the very human stuff. How am I a sensitive friend? How can I be a friend who is sensitive to your needs? Well, there are ways. Maslow, for instance, is the guy who invents what is called the Maslow scale or the Maslow hierarchy of values. And Maslow says there are physical and security issues in most human lives. There are emotional and feeling type issues in most people's lives. There are intellectual issues, left brain, mind, rationality type issues. And there are spiritual and aesthetic and self-realizational type of issues. And that's a kind of hierarchy, 4 steps. He has, I think, actually 8. He subdivides them. But roughly speaking, it's physical, emotional, intellectual, and spiritual in that order. And his argument is that if you have a problem at a lower step, there's static that's produced there that does not allow you to participate fully on the step above. Perfect example is the counselor who's sitting in the office, as I sometimes am at the campus, and a student comes into the door and says, "Hey, tell me about the doctrine of the teleological suspension of the ethical." I mean, not many students ask that question, but some do. And I can see the student is wringing his hands, and I start to answer, you see, on the intellectual level, but what's really bugging him is something at the emotional level. And I have to be sensitive enough to listen to his body language as well as his words. You get what I'm saying? And if I answered him just at the intellectual level and explained to him the doctrine of the teleological suspension of the ethical, you know, he'd go away unsatisfied. I would not have listened to him. So we have to learn to listen to one another, and there are steps and ways to do that, and there are courses you can take and books you can read, and my wife is doing some of that this week. That's sensitive listening. 12, I'm getting down to fasting now. Fasting. I love this idea of having a hunger meal every week. Maybe we should do that in our homes. And maybe every week in Advent and in Lent, as examples, we might fast for one day as a spiritual exercise, and then to save the money and give that to the poor. You'd be surprised how fasting can clean out your system, among other things, physically, and also raise your consciousness then about the poor. If a total fast is foreign to you or sounds too severe, how about a little juice in the morning and a little tea and rice later in the day? But not a big feast. Just an austere meal. I also love, and this is the next thing on my list, number 13, diet, eating lower on the food chain. You are aware that the Holden Village Kitchen is committed to that. Not so much red meat. Red meat is probably bad for us in the quantities that North Americans have been eating it anyhow. So they're saying, eat meat as a condiment, like the Chinese and the Japanese do, mixed in with chop suey and that kind of stuff, or spaghetti or whatever. And eat fish and eat eggs and eat chicken, but only half as much red meat as you normally eat. Eating lower on the food chain, more like a vegetarian. And also then, rhythms of feast and fast. I think it's a pity that we've lost that sense of feast and fast. Christmas is no good if all of Advent you're feasting. Advent should be a fast in preparation for the feast of Christmas. Same with Easter and Lent. Easter ought to be a great feast, but if you're feasting every day during Lent as well, it's lost its grip on our sensibilities. So let's have more austere kind of meals during Lent. 7 weeks, that's not too long. A tithe of the year. A tenth of the year. A more austere diet. And then a real wonderful fast on Easter. Yeah. And the 7 weeks following Easter. That's a whole feast, season of feast. The next thing I have on my list is physical exercise, number 14. Physical exercise, again, your billboard. I don't know what you do. Do you walk? Do you swim? Do you jog? Do you run? Do you play sports? You know, all of those things are possibilities, but we ought to keep in shape physically as well as intellectually and emotionally and spiritually. And it's your billboard. Again, people look at you and you say, an advertisement for the faith. Body awareness exercises is number 15. Sense awareness exercises, touch awareness exercises. We did the crazy back rubs and foot rubs and head rubs and so on a few minutes ago in here. Marvelous stuff. We ought to do more of that. I got books in my library about sense exercises, how to go outside and appreciate this wonderful world we have. We should learn how to do that. Tithe, I have that on my list, number 16. One-tenth of our income to charity or to causes outside our own household or outside ourselves. Jim Wallace, do you know Jim Wallace from Sojourners? He says, the poor are not our problem. We are the problem of the poor. And I think that's true. How about a tithe of our gross national product at the national level? Do you want your grandchildren to say of you that you were the people who built bombs and not houses for the poor in our cities? Are we willing to pay any expense for bigger and better weapons? That bothers my conscience. Well, how we spend our money, that's a spiritual problem, I think. The six works of mercy is number 17 on my list. You read Matthew 25, he talks about Jesus talks about if you have fed the hungry or given drink to the thirsty, he has this whole list here, six of them, you've done it as if to me. And the six are feeding the hungry, giving drink to the thirsty, showing hospitality to the stranger. Very important. Think of our churches. How hospitable are our churches on Sunday morning? Clothing the naked, caring for the sick, visiting the imprisoned. Those are the six works of mercy. Seventh, if you want to include burying the dead. Then I got 18, 19, and 20 that I added just last week. 18 is friendship, especially soul friendship. Do you have a friend that you can cry on the shoulder of? Let's take a survey. How many of you have a friend like that? Apart from your spouse now, or you do, wonderful. You don't know how rich you are. Wonderful. Make the most of that friendship. And be a friend to somebody else. Within the first year that I came to the university where I now serve, I sent a letter to 12 faculty people. I didn't know most of them, but all I knew about them was that they had a wound, that they had just been through a divorce maybe, or their spouse had died, or there was a sickness in the family or something like that. But these were 12 people whom I had heard about who had some kind of wound in their life. And I invited them to come to have lunch with me on a regular basis every 2 weeks and just talk about that. I call it theology and therapy. And we would talk about the faith, but we would also talk about healing and how our wounds are can be healed by one another. Well, that was 4 years ago, and the group is still going. I got 11 responses out of those 12 letters. Must have hit a chord. The spouses of those people, it happens now that the current group is all men, but the wives of those men come to me and they say, you don't know what that group means to my husband, that he's got a male friend that he can talk to. Males, women I think are different, but males, you know, we're competitors all the time. We're not trained, we're not socialized to open up to each other the way women are. I think maybe women do it better than men do, but men have to learn too. And friendship is going to be a very significant thing, I think, in the next generation. How to be a soul friend to somebody else. 19 I've got on my list is community or communal support groups, like this group of men who meet at my house for lunch every 2 weeks. We need a one-on-one friend, but we need a little community too. Sometimes you don't find it in church. Or maybe you've got to take some of those people from the church and have like a little house church or a little cottage meeting or a little base community or a cell group or a koinonia group or whatever. Do some of you have those in your churches? Raise your hand. Cell groups or koinonia groups or whatever. Yeah, I think they're very valuable. And we need those things. And the final thing I have is creativity. Bake a cake. Paint a wall. Write a song, knit a sweater. All that stuff helps you keep the creative juices flowing and makes you a better billboard. We've got to quit. But thank you very much. This has been fun.